Welcome back to CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. I'm your host, Adam Horner. With 30 years in the industry, including over a decade as a CTO, I have coached and mentored more than 100 engineers and tech leaders. This podcast covers crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook to excel in your role. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Daniel Walters, who, like me, is a CTO coach and fractional CTO. Daniel is now based in New Zealand and has extensive technical leadership experience from his native Australia and across Southeast Asia. Daniel has led and advised significant organizational change programs as a CTO, and in this episode, we talk about his experiences and what he learned from integrating two competing startups into a regional powerhouse in the recruiting space. I'll also be asking him why so many CTOs feel the need to restructure their organization and what his playbook is for going about it in the best way possible. Keep listening to find out his surprising anecdotal measurement for leadership success in the process. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Yeah. So we're on the tail end of winter here in Auckland, New Zealand. So we're looking forward to warmer months.
Yeah, so we're exactly the opposite ends of the world. So it's kind of fun operating across two different hemispheres. We're just at the height of summer at the moment. Sun is blazing here in northern Sweden, or southern Sweden, I should say, but northern hemisphere. We have about 18 hours of sunshine a day at the moment. It's the exact opposite of what you have, I imagine.
Oh, look forward to that.
So let's talk about organizational change then. But before we get into that, let's just talk a little bit about you, Daniel. So you've had quite a remarkable career across quite a few different sectors. Can you just share some of your background, some of the highlights maybe, and some of the sort of the big things that have shaped your approach to technology leadership?
I started in games development very early on, but I won't spend too much time talking about that, apart from saying it was a boom and bust sort of industry. And so I quickly found myself moving into internet technologies. And so we might fast forward to a point in my career where I was working for Hitwise. And so Hitwise specialized in online consumer behavior. And I was in the technology leadership team there. And we built all sorts of interesting stuff, you know, dashboarding products, analytical, you know, charting. Also led the team that did the middleware there. Why that experience is interesting and relevant, I was also involved in the due diligence for the sale of Hitwise to a company that I later joined, which was Experian. And so Experian, for those who may not be familiar, owns some of the largest credit bureaus around the world. And so coming from this sort of Web 2.0 internet darling that, you know, went from a startup to a scale up and being on that journey that whole time, and then joining a much larger organization was an interesting experience for me.
I can imagine that one. I worked with Experian when I was in the UK in the fintech arena, and they're quite a bureaucratic organization at times. That must have been almost culture shock.
It was culture shock, but it was also a good experience. I ended up staying on. So there was, you know, some golden handcuffs initially, but even when those were taken off, I found that Experian invested a lot in training and leadership learning, and so I got a lot of support. And so, yes, Experian did like a good restructure. It was, after all, led by, you know, financiers and accountants. So I'm sure later in this episode we might delve into some of the connections there in terms of how financials lead to restructures and things like that. But there was a lot of good, and I really appreciated the commitment to investing in people's growth and learning at Experian.
And so was that some of the sort of the early experience of coaching that you had in your career as well then?
Coaching and also being coached. Yeah. So in the startup space, that was not, no one had time for that. And you know, you learned a lot on the job, but at Experian and other, you know, companies like Seek that I work for, those were, I guess, you know, more enterprise level organizations. But those were two organizations in particular that had a big focus on learning. And that's something that stayed with me.
Cool. Because you were at Seek for a while, weren't you? Do you want to just tell us a bit about that experience as well?
Yeah. So it's an interesting leap from Experian to Seek. And the missing link there is after a year or two when I was in the Hitwise team but acquired by Experian, the opportunity came to move to Malaysia. So my girlfriend, soon to be wife, and I packed up our bags from Melbourne, Australia, and moved to Kuala Lumpur. And I helped set up a development center there, and then later filled a position of leading, consumer insights portion of that development center. And so my role there was to build up teams, not just to support Hitwise, but other Experian product lines to expand their development capabilities. And so built up a team of, I was the first employee and built up a team of 70 over a few years. And it was whilst I was in Malaysia that Seek came across me. They had acquired JobsDB out of Hong Kong and JobStreet out of Malaysia, which were the two largest employment marketplaces in the Southeast Asia region. And so through acquiring both of those companies, they formed Seek Asia, which was the Southeast Asian job marketplace for Seek. And they were looking for a CTO. And somehow my name came up. And it's interesting because I was well known to Seek back when I worked in Australia. We used to be, Hitwise office used to be across the road. But of all places, they found me in Kuala Lumpur. So yeah. And I end up spending 5 years as the CTO and CIO for Seek Asia.
Cool. And so as sort of wearing both roles, that meant you're responsible for the infrastructure, the operations, the desktop environment, as well as for engineering, innovation and product as well. Is that right?
That is correct. It was my first C-level role, and maybe I was a little bit naive in that a lot of my previous experience, I had some in IT and operations, but a lot of my previous experience was focused on software product development. So a lot of my questions were focused on that. And from their perspective, that was where they had the biggest need. It just so happened that that portfolio of responsibilities for all of IT actually still sat with that role, because that's how it was with the previous person in the position. And so in the end, probably the IT parts ended up being maybe 60% of the role in terms of complexity, because there were 8 countries, probably about 15 or 16 offices. There was networking between those. There was multiple product lines. Yeah, it was a very complex environment.
A big introduction to operations, and then obviously with that, therefore, some of the shifts in organizational structure that were obviously necessary to run an organization that size.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that a role prior to that one that was wedged in between the Experian one and the Seek one, I did some work with a company called Prestarion, who were bidding for a concession for the Malaysian government, so specifically with their immigration department, to replace their IT infrastructure for all of Malaysia. And so I got to spend 6 months with some smart people learning about how they thought about, all the data centers and connectivity. And so, didn't mean I knew everything, but I knew enough to at least get started. Yeah.
Cool. So, and then from there to the current date, I mean, what is it you're doing at the moment, and sort of what was the quick version of the journey from that bit? Because I think those are probably the two biggest or longest tenures that you had, if I've got it right.
Yes. Yeah. Earlier in my career, there was other stuff. But in terms of today, I am focused on being a CTO coach, fractional CTO, and a consultant on topics like technology strategy. So part of the, as we established at the start, I'm now living in Auckland, New Zealand. So now onto my third country. And part of the motivation for moving there, my wife grew up in New Zealand, and I have a 6-year-old son. And so when he was 2, we thought, well, this is a good opportunity to move from Malaysia to New Zealand so he can grow up with his cousins. And so, coaching has come about because, A, I see the need. There's a lot of CTOs like me when I joined Seek as a new CTO who needs some help and support. So that's what I'm doing now.
That's amazing. It's very similar to how I see the market as well, that there's a lot of people who are in a CTO role with probably less than 5 years experience and a lot of questions.
Yeah. I'm also seeing people who have had 10 or more years experience as a CTO or CIO who also have a lot of questions. So the market has moved in terms of, you know, big data and AI and cybersecurity risks. And, you know, there's been so many big trends that have caught some people where, you know, what was working for them before is not working for them now. And so, yeah, there's a whole range of challenges for CTOs.
Cool. I mean, that seems, and a lot of those changes at the end of the day come down to industry trends and industry changes. But also, I think when a CTO joins an organization, they often sort of think, what changes should I make or what changes can I make? And that's really what we want to get into today, which is one of those areas, I think, where there is an instinct, isn't there, do you think, with a lot of CTOs that join an organization, let's make some changes. Is that something you've seen a lot as well?
I've been on the receiving end of it as well. And a shame to say, I've also, you know, early on made the mistake of you know, making some changes too quickly myself. So where to start with this one? I think let's start with the impact of change on people. So like the sort of feelings that you can experience. I had one change early in my career where I was working in a QA and sales team role, and someone in our team refreshed the website and saw our names go off the website. You know what I mean? So it's those sort, you know, there can be a whole spectrum of experiences that people go through when companies change. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, companies are great at making the change, but not great at thinking through the impact for the people experiencing the change. And so I think that has uniquely given me some amount of empathy for what the impact of change might be.
Yeah, and I think that emotional roller coaster that people go through, that can be caused by small changes, like a simple change in title, all the way through to full-on organizational restructures with departments disappearing and others being formed and so on. So I think the impact it has on people, it's not a small thing. And also, I think there is an element of people that if those changes happen too often or too close together, that can also feel quite scary, disorienting, and not fun as well. Is that something you've also experienced, where change comes sort of thick and fast in an organization?
Yes. So not to pick on Experian, but it was a matrixed organization and a relatively young company. So it was the result of a couple of demergers. It's a credit bureaus coming together. And so it was still finding its way. And as a result of that, there was quite frequent changes that would come through. And I don't know how it is today, but that was certainly, I was there with Experian for 7 years. And that was, I'm probably experienced seven restructures over that time.
Wow. Yeah. Because they do have a huge number of products, don't they, which can logically be organized in a multitude of different ways. And it does seem that they've experimented with, I don't know, most of them.
That's right. And yeah, so there is a relationship there. Sometimes it's with the leader, or I'd say even often it's with the leader. So if there's a change of leader to make their mark, then they may feel a bold and noticeable change might be changing the structure of how people are organized.
And that's interesting. So do you feel as though that instinct to make your mark is one of the biggest drivers behind at least engineering organizational changes when there is a change of leadership?
I think so. I think there's a definitely, it's almost like an ego connection there. But there also is maybe oversimplified thinking about, if I change the relationship between how they, you know, what these people are responsible for, or how, you know, their place in the organization, an assumption that that's in itself will translate through to performance. And the reality is that is just a small part of any change and what makes teams work. And it's normally, you know, not considering things like the identity of teams and making explicit what are the expected interactions of teams and what is the theory of how this is expected to work. In a lot of the restructures that I see, both, you know, through my career experience and through the coaching and consulting I do, a lot of restructures lack consideration for those human elements. You know, they're very focused on changing the you know, the the shape of the tree, you know, the reporting tree, but not on the other aspects that actually exist to make the dynamics work in a workplace.
So that's an interesting way of looking at it, because I think what you're suggesting then is perhaps a lot of people look at it too much as like a theoretical paper-based exercise where they're thinking, okay, if I make these changes, I should see these outcomes, almost like a formula. Whereas in reality, people's emotions, people's reactions, and people's collaboration and also communication gets significantly impacted. I'm often reminded of sort of the situational leadership curve where you sort of end up with that the stages of the team formation. And I think as soon as you bring change into a team, you sort of slip back down that curve, going from performing back to normalizing, and further back you end up in the storming phase, which of course is where there's actual infighting or conflict in the team. Are those the kind of human elements that you're wary of? Because they're the sort of things that I've picked up from time to time and seen that, you know, okay, if we do these changes in a way without thinking about the people, we could end up with exactly those kinds of impacts.
Yeah, we were influenced by that thinking, and when we were approaching change, particularly once we got a little bit more seasons with it, we would basically work off the assumption that even if the personnel within a team, like a team, changed by one, that maybe one person in, one person out, someone exchanged, we assumed that the team was moving back to a storming stage, which, you know, is not always negative. So when teams storm, they might re-establish norms and other team agreements and commitments. So we used dynamic re-teaming approaches as part of our approach to change, and used if we were going to make a change that would cause that level of disruption, use that as an opportunity to support the team with more learning, more team building and other aspects, working on the human collaboration aspects, so that after they move back into that sort of performing mode, would hopefully be performing at a higher level.
But that's quite an advanced use case there, isn't it? Where you're predicting how the human reaction is going to happen, and you're almost making the change in order to force that as a change, as opposed to just thinking about, okay, well, if I have this person reporting to that person and that group reporting there, then my life as a leader is easier. But I think we focus quite a lot there on sort of the sort of default reasons for change. Whereas I think there are, on the other side of it, there is also the aspect of the reason that a lot of CTOs are brought in is to fix a problem or to change a structure or change a culture. So I think on that side, there is also the impetus that change is expected and sometimes even mandated in the appointment to the CTO.
Yeah, and that was true for me as well. So for the Seek Asia role, they'd acquired two companies and then formed the Seek Asia business and then hired me with two companies that were on the books, but in no way integrated at all. So, you know, I joined there for the start of that journey. And so there was definitely a mandate for me to bring about some change. And, you know, some people were excited about me joining and some people were really worried. On the first day, I turned up and at 9 a.m. they had a company-wide, you know, like live stream out to all the offices and all the technology teams from all the different country locations were dialed in. And so they did a bit of introduction and then they opened up for Q&A. And one of the first questions I got was, okay, Daniel, what plans do you have for changing things here? You know, what are you going to do to us?
Wow, talk about being put on the spot.
Yeah, I was quite proud of my response where I said, yesterday I was working for a different company. I had my farewell dinner last night and it's 9 a.m. So I'm going to spend at least 90 days getting to know you all. I'm going to travel to all the offices and I'm going to listen to what is the state of play for all of you. And I'm going to, you know, start to synthesize that. And I think there was a sigh of relief when that was my answer.
I think that's a wonderful response. Just out of interest, what was it that drove you to say 90 days? Was it something that you picked out of the air, or was there some rationale behind that sort of 90 days, 3 months kind of time frame?
I think I probably had read an HBR article that suggested that that was a sensible time period, and it resonated with me having that previous experience of seeing revolving doors of leaders coming in and making changes based on, you know, they could in a time frame where they couldn't possibly have known enough about the organization to have made a change. So now that didn't mean that the first few changes I made were without their flaws. There certainly was a lot of learning, but yeah, I'm really glad that I took that 90 days and I didn't go through with, you know, any sort of big bang change. We were.
So let's talk about the process of assessing the teams then, because by the sounds of it, you went to visit, if not all, then most of the offices and therefore talked to a lot of the people in the organization. I'd love you to just talk us through what it was that you were looking for, what you were trying to find out, and what was your sort of game plan in terms of structuring all the information that you picked up from all the people that you spoke to in the organization?
Yeah, so firstly, I wanted to meet with individuals and teams. I mean, it was over 200 people, so in some cases it was meeting with groups, in other cases it was meeting with individuals. But I really wanted to listen and understand what were their sources of friction or frustration, like where did they feel stuck? Because I thought for some of these situations, they may be trying to push in a direction that was already positive for the organization, but maybe experiencing some friction that, you know, was slowing that down. And in other examples, there may be, you know, there were changes that people were worried about and had already, you know, assumed were happening. So for instance, with two companies coming together, that means a lot of duplication. So a lot of anxiety is there around, well, does that mean that, you know, they're going to just keep the JobsDB team or just the JobStreet team? So a lot of the time when I'm meeting with these teams, they're already listening for any indication that I may be going to make a choice that might leave them redundant or the size of the responsibilities reduced or some other big impact for them. And so I would listen for what were their initial questions, what were the things they wanted to know to try and get a sense of what their key concerns were. And then if I felt like I'd identify those, then I would start to drill in further.
And were you able to actually provide any reassurances at that stage? I'm going to guess not, because you're still trying to figure out which were the ones you were going to keep or which ones you needed to rationalize.
Yeah, that's true in the early days, although fortunately I was using that sort of 90 days to go like, well, I am in listening mode. So that was the main message that I repeated. But over time, I started to form some views about things that didn't need to change, things that weren't going to be a priority for us, and some things that would be a priority. And so then I would start to share some questions that might help me get some information about each of those areas. And if where the opportunity was there to reduce anxiety by, let's say, we could make an assurance about a particular area, then we would get that news out there and communicated. And the more calm people that you have to collaborate with, the more you can get done. So we tried hard to get to a position where more and more people were feeling calm and confident. There was one other thing that helped in this situation, which is both businesses had underinvested pretty significantly, in my view. They were quite frugal businesses, and that had been good because they were competing head-to-head with each other. But now they were in the same company, and now they're facing global competitors like LinkedIn and Indeed and Facebook Jobs and Google Jobs. So, you know, the situation had changed. The war chests of those companies we were competing with were much larger. And so I knew that A, we could probably leverage all of the team members, and B, we probably need to also spend significantly more. And so with those two things, you could start to give pretty positive assurances about the longevity of people's roles. Now, their responsibilities might change. You know, we're going to be taking on more, but at least their jobs were safe. And so then people could concentrate on, okay, well, what is it that we need to do to win?
And I guess very early on then, you're sort of laying out a new and different strategy that wasn't possible before, because the very point of you joining was a significant change.
That's right. Yeah. It was linked to a significant change. And this may be a good example of, there was one change early on where I was like, okay, I can see we LinkedIn and Indeed and other companies are moving in aggressively. We are clearly fairly inefficient now we're together. You know, there were two quite efficient businesses separately, but together, you know, with all the duplication, there were some opportunities there. And so I made a change, which was for each of the teams that were working on duplicated bits of software to start collaborating with each other and at least assessing what we had, what was similar, what was different. And that was positive in that it was it started us on the path, but I probably could have spent even a little bit more time before we started on that, because only 12 months later, we made a more significant change. We're now a chief product officer joined, and the two of us collaborated on what was a clearer vision for how the company would be shaped. And so, yeah, that's probably my one regret, is that we started making some changes, and then there was a few people who went through a second change when they may not have needed to.
Okay. So, I mean, I was going to ask you that, what are the things that you would have done differently? But so therefore, ending up in a situation where you had basically fairly close together changes to the same people in the same area, how could you have avoided that though? It does seem as though you had more information once the CPO joined. Do you think there was more information you could have gathered in those first 90 days to be aware of that?
It's hard. I don't know the answer to that. But what I do know is the approach that we took to the second change is probably how I would approach change moving forward in not just that organization, but in other scenarios as well. And so I mentioned earlier things like dynamic reteaming and things like that. So I'll paint a picture of how we approach the second change.
Just perhaps before we do that, maybe it's just worth summarizing those first 90 days, that sort of discovery phase, if you like. So from what I've picked up from what you said, you were looking for the good things and figuring out any changes that had been assumed and how valid and correct they were for the people who were there, testing the assumptions. You were, as far as I can tell, making as few commitments as you could, but providing reassurances where it was obvious. You're figuring out priorities. Those were the things that were most urgent to look at and dealing with those first. You were collaborating, which is an interesting thing, and not only making changes, but also looking for areas where you needed to invest. And in this case, it was really where there had been underinvestments until that point as well. And then you started with that information to start to form your new strategy. And the only other thing that you've said there's one thing to avoid, I think, is to set yourself up for serial changes, especially if they're quite close together. Is that a reasonable summary so far?
It is. And to illustrate an example where could have done it better. So one of the areas I'm quite passionate about is having feedback loops. And so some of the things that I did, rather than focusing on how we're changing the org structure and things like that, I focused on what the incentives could be. And some of those incentives can be soft incentives, like feedback loops, like access to the data on the area that we're working on and things like that. So these businesses were struggling with qualitative issues in their products. And so we bought some TV screens. We got some visual radiators established for a few teams. And the misstep there was a couple of teams, I would later find out, were waiting to know whether they could backfill some talent. And then elsewhere, they saw some TV screens being installed and mounted. And so I got a question at a town hall, which is, are we replacing some of the, you know, our former teammates with televisions? And I mean, it sounds sort of like a ridiculous question, but I am extremely empathetic towards it, because as far as what I'd communicated and what they could see, that was a conclusion that was led to. And it was experiences like that which led me to also become very passionate about communication channels and repetition in communication and communicating across multiple channels and things like that. Because as a leader who is a leader of leaders, your messages, no matter how well-intended, can go through change and morph and things like that. So I learned a lot through those early experiences.
Yeah, you often can't repeat yourself enough. I think that's one of the things that comes up regularly in my coaching as well, is multi-channel communication and repetition. the clarity is not nearly so important as the repetition, staggeringly, isn't it?
I tend to say repeat it like 5 times in 5 different channels and you'll reach 80% of your intended audience.
Yeah, it's amazing how much effort it takes. Cool. So then see, if we move on from the gathering information and then to actually making the changes, because I think there's 2 parts to it. Is one is how do we develop our new restructuring target? And then how do we actually run the strategy to make the change towards the target?
Yeah. So for the first part, so we used a variety of heuristics. So domain-driven design was an influence. Team topologies, the book had not come out at that point. So this is a little bit earlier, but sources that influenced that book, such as work by Evan Botcher at ThoughtWorks. You know, he was an ex-colleague of mine, and he also did some talks for Seek. So yeah, we had access to all these ideas about platforms and other things going around. And so we built up a 1-page visual view of how we thought, based on what we knew at that point in time, we might need to be organized. And then we socialized it. We spent about 2 or 3 months socializing the view of how we would organize. And it wasn't an org chart. It wasn't like your classic upside down tree diagram. It was a visual block diagram showing interactions between different teams. Seek, being focused on employment marketplaces, is about 2-sided markets. So you've got services for candidates and services for employers. And so we had teams that would be organized around different parts of the customer journey. And so through a combination of thinking about customer journeys and thinking about domain design in terms of the software services that supported those, made that sort of visual picture. And so it being visual meant that we could include it in our communications and get feedback and ask people like, what do you think of this? How do you think it might impact you? Could you imagine yourself contributing to some of these teams? What might be different for you? All of those elements. So yeah, that was the main vehicle of giving people a vision or a view about what things might look like, you know, 18 months, 24 months down the track.
That's interesting. So you didn't use an org chart at all. You just used basically a blocks and lines diagram to show where or how people would be working in sort of the teams, the functional units, what the domains, if you like. Did you get any questions then that came back that prompted you to change your thinking as you went along?
We did. And I guess the second detail to emphasize is the messaging around the diagram was, this is our best understanding based on today. We will learn throughout this process. We're not doing a big bang change. So we will focus. I think we focused on a couple of candidate teams first on a particular pressing need for the organization. We supported those teams going through. We hired. So we went through like a internal hiring process. The good thing about approaching it with an internal hiring process was you basically could identify the early adopters within your organization. So which of the team are feeling most comfortable with embracing the change and having them put up their hands to say, hey, yeah, I'm interested in what this team is, what its purpose is, and I'd like to get involved. So we iteratively went through the change like that, and we would spend 2 or 3 months working with the team that had formed and supporting them as much as we could. I'd hired up internal coaches within my teams. So people who had both, one guy who was he'd had a Scrum background, but an interest in coaching. And so he became an agile coach who worked with the teams. We had someone similar with similar experience in the design area, someone else in the architecture area. So there were a lot of people whose instincts were about helping others and coaching and giving feedback who then would support the teams. And so rather than doing many teams at once, we did 1 or 2 teams each round and then only moved on to the next round when we felt there was a good level of stability with the teams we'd been focusing on.
And I think that strikes me as something that's different from most reorganizations in that you pitched it from the beginning as an evolution. You didn't try and change too much at once. and you deliberately took the steps to learn from each sort of phase or stage that you went through to feed back into the next stages. And I really love that idea of internal hiring, because that really does allow you to show who the big proponents of it are, and therefore your biggest sort of cheerleaders and supporters through the change process.
It does. And there's an interesting pattern as the rest of the organization see people get involved and it not turning out to be so scary for them, the comfort level increases. And so the next wave of people start to be more ready to get involved. And so when you run the next recruitment, more people put their hands up. And, you know, by after 12 months, even the people who were most worried about the change or most comfortable could see that most people who had gotten involved had not only gone through the change, but actually benefited. They had learned new skills. They had, you know, found more career options. We had, you know, QAs that switched over and became software developers. We had support staff that became software developers. We had software developers who came up, became architects. We had designers that switched into product roles, you know, so there was a lot of movement that was enabled. And we invested a lot in learning and training and support to enable people through this.
And that sounds to me almost bang on sort of the best practices that I've seen in terms of the way to go, in terms of supporting people through change in changes that you hadn't necessarily planned from your sort of top-down strategic approach to it, but that come out through the people's wishes, career, you know, goals, their personal career goals. And it comes back to the empathy, doesn't it? Being able to listen to people and enable personal change as well as organizational or corporate change.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some have called like agile approaches to change, and where I think this was definitely agile influenced and adaptive. But where I think this was different is it was combined with a view, like a visual view of the future. Like, you know, there was an actual theory of what the, like, there was a theory on how this would work. It wasn't 100% right. We had to keep modifying it and adjusting it as we learned things along the way. But when I contrast that to some other ones I was involved in my career where it was just purely, you know, reorganize to what was in front of you and then do the next thing and the next thing, without that counterbalance of a longer term view, it's not a very humane experience, because the complete flexibility can be very stressful on people. And so one of the reasons why we invested in that, like quite heavily into that model and you know, making it very visually clear and also visually aesthetically enticing as well, was to give some comfort that there had been some thinking and some analysis and, you know, feedback taken in. It's just an interesting contrast where you can go like, okay, well, the old way was very top down and rigid and, you know, big change, you know, once every 3 years, and, you know, once it's done, it's baked. And then there's this other extreme, which was like completely flexible, you know, adapt and change as you go along, but no long term. And so for us, the balance in the middle was have some vision of where you're going, but be open to adjust it based on what you're learning and what you're seeing.
Yeah. And I think the other key thing that you mentioned there is turning the change into an evolutionary aspect that is tied into the core strategy of the business, never mind the technology, but the core strategy of the business, which provides, I guess, some emotional stability about direction, about purpose, and about an individual's role through the change, but also with the organization as a whole.
That was something that I was very fortunate to have at Seek. So that's a very purpose-driven business. And so you were improving lives through connecting people to careers. And so that purpose, you know, was a good sort of North Star, that, you know, a good starting point. There's a lot of investment in strategy at that business. So there was quite good clarity about, you know, how the dynamics of the two-sided marketplace would work and where, what the theory was in terms of where good progress could aid dynamics of the market and the network effects and those sorts of things. So yeah, there was lots of good foundations in that business that helped us.
I can only imagine. That sounds fantastic. Let's have a look for a moment then at some of those things that don't go so smoothly, that, you know, they end up providing friction, challenges and resistance to the change. Did you have to overcome elements of that during that that really long restructuring, reorganization process?
Yeah, there was a lot. Before I get into friction on restructuring, so I'll make reference to a book called Six Simple Rules. And this book is written by some management consultants who I think had observed a lot of restructures themselves. And the most interesting observation in that book is, out of all the tools you have for bringing about positive change, restructuring is probably should be the last tool in the toolbox. And so the book talks about the other tools that you have, like incentives, and, you know, not just hard incentives, but soft incentives, like, you know, who are they managed by and what is the information they have access to and what is the context they have access to and who provides them feedback, you know, all of those sorts of things. So I was influenced by that book as well, of if we were going to restructure, it meant that we had exhausted the other options on the table for achieving the outcome that we were looking for. And only then, you know, having exhausted those, would we look at a team structure change as an answer.
That's a great point.
So in terms of some of the friction for actual changes, we had examples. So some of the early teams, we asked them what tools would they need access to. And unsurprisingly, majority of them being software engineers, there was a preference for, you know, Mac laptops and things like that. I knew that if I could support the team with equipment that was at least more than adequate to developing software, that might be a good boost. So we invested in some of those, but we started with those teams that are going through the change. Now that instantly increased friction between that team and other teams looking on. So there were lots of lessons. We then, you know, communicated with the rest of the teams, like, hey, as you go through this, you will get the opportunity to let us know what equipment you need. So we eventually smoothed that over, and everyone eventually got the equipment that they were after. But yeah, there was a lot of learning.
So you sort of worked out almost as an experience to use that as an incentive rather than to create a division with it.
Yeah, that's right. And that's probably, you know, have your time again, you would communicate it as such the very first time. But some of these things, you know, seem obvious in hindsight, but as you're feeling your way through it, sometimes you run into those.
No, well, hopefully that's one of those ones that our listeners can add to their playbooks as they think about how they can go through change. Because I think almost every developer I've ever spoken to has wanted a new laptop. And so it seems like a very, as you say, obvious in hindsight incentive you can use to get people to go through change. Is just, I would not want to use the word bribe, but to provide a cherry on top to the process that they're going to go through, which is probably going to be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, some people saw that a little bit cynically at first as well. So you've got to be careful with all of these. And my core belief was having the right tools for the job was the starting point. So that needed to be the key message to communicate. One other aspect of the incentives. So something that we found was really powerful for team cohesion was team identity. So what I mean by team identity is, how do the team recognize that they're part of the team? You know, that can be in how they dress, that can be how they organize around their work environment, that might be their team ceremonies, that might be their, you know, their values and core beliefs. And so as part of the boot camps I mentioned earlier, as part of that, you know, supporting the team formation, we provided them some budget for investing in things like that. It's like, hey, if you want to invest, you know, if you want to design a logo, work with the designers and design a logo for the team. If you want to put some, you know, come up with a name that you're all proud of for the team. If you want to put some decoration around, you know, the pod of desks where you're all situated, you know, there are all sorts of creative ways that the teams expressed and explored their identity. Some teams chose to make commitments in terms of, you know, what their standards were. Other teams, you know, they put a lot of focus on what their practice. We supported, you know, scrum teams, Kanban teams, you know, chat ops teams. There were a lot of different practices and aspects that formed up the team's identity. So yeah, we put a lot of investment in that, and that in my belief helped bring the teams together quickly and led to some really good performance.
Sounds like a really good unifying way to get the teams to work together early on something that is perhaps not as consequential in terms of productivity, but definitely in terms of as you say, bringing them together. Were there any particular, I mean, because you mentioned that you invested in that, was that time? Was it actual, you know, good old fashioned dollars? Was it supporting materials? What did the investment actually look like there to create that opportunity for those teams to be creatively identified?
Yeah, it was all of those. So it was time, it was dollars. So, you know, so they'd, some teams got hoodies printed with their logos they designed on them. You know, some teams built, you know, had some banners made. Some of them, you know, there was the time of the, so we had, as I mentioned, various internal coaches. So they would block out, you know, a fortnight of time in the, you know, for the boot camp and also follow up activities and other things like that. So they would get support from that perspective. I mean, our view was, there's that saying about sharpening the axe or sharpening the saw, right? So, you know, where you'll spend 4 hours to sharpen the axe so I can chop down the trees faster. Our view was, if we thought an investment, whether it was in learning, whether it was in team building, if we thought that would bring us up to a high level of performance, then it would pay for itself over a particular period of time. And so we would try take a view on what that period of time would be and make choices about what we'd invest in. And in our experience, the more we invested in learning and supporting teams, the higher the performance of the teams. And so we would make time for those things. That organization over a couple of years went from really struggling in terms of the quality of the products. They'd, you know, only shipped product updates once a month, and they moved to, you know, sometimes thousands of deployments per week. You know, availability went from like 98%, you know, it's like days of the year downtime to 99.99% availability. Like, there was real outcomes that positively impacted customers. We refreshed all the mobile apps for almost 10 million users across Southeast Asia. Like, we moved mountains.
And that's a really difficult point, isn't it, about restructuring and changing organizations, is how do you know when it's worked? What does success look like? How did you go about thinking from the point of view at the beginning, how you measured success? And then what did you learn about that measurement of success as you went along through that evolution?
Yeah, I think my view of what success was early on was more naive compared to later on. So initially, I was, you know, I'd come from environments where there was, you know, good team-based software development, and then I walked into this new organization, and the teams were struggling with, you know, with producing reliable software at any decent rate. And so initially I was quite focused on how could I at least get us to a standard which I knew had existed elsewhere. There was limitations with that approach. Like, yes, we did make progress, but over the course of the time there, I realized that there were opportunities to connect the teams with, like, to get closer and closer to what the users were experiencing. So the users, like, being the candidates and the employers using our products. And the benefit of that was not just could we get better results, but there was line of sight from the team members and the work they did day to day through to the outcomes that they could achieve for candidates and hirers. We would do things like every week there was either candidate, like groups of 10 or 15 or 20 candidates or hirers coming in to our offices. Like, the team could view them through. We set up use Zoom for like a two-way, you know, almost like a double-sided mirror type thing. So they could see the user tests and seeing what's working and where the frustration was, so that, you know, if we were developing and delivering very slow software, you know, that could cause a lot of frustration, they would see those come through in those user tests. And so over time, we shifted to be a lot more outcomes focused and mapping out, okay, well, what is our theory from, you know, the software changes we're making through to what sort of cause and effect does that through to all the way through to the user. And so that, I think, was an improvement in terms of our framing of. And then I had one more, which I think was important for me as a leader to know that if I was being an effective leader. And the way I described that was, if I, as I was, you know, going around the organization or talking to people, if I observed things that surprised me, which were positive, so, you know, for instance, they've just, you know, did something innovative with some software that achieved something I didn't know was possible, or they came up with a new product feature that, you know, it just that had been inspired by the team's customer conversations, and then they'd gone and done it. The more often that was happening, so the more often I was pleasantly surprised by things that never originated with me or the other members of the leadership team, then I knew that I was doing something right as a leader, because that was good evidence to say that I was creating an environment that was conducive to creative people doing good work and getting good results.
And do you think that that sort of instinct, that it's quite a subjective measure, isn't it? But do you think that tied back to the original reason that you were brought into the organization in the first place? In terms of what the expectations on you were?
I think that may have exceeded the expectations. So I think at the time I was brought in, it was like, we want a problem solved. And the problem at that time was, should we even bring these teams together, or do we need to keep it? You know, it was those strategic choices. And so this was more, once we've made those initial choices, how do you keep getting better? How do you keep, you know, growing the pool of what's possible?
Got it. So your goals, your sort of aims of what you're going for, were continually leveling up as you were beginning to level up the organization as you went.
Yeah, yeah. Not just for me, for all the executive leadership and you know, there was leadership all through the organization. When you get to the point where there are teams that can spot customer problems and then originate solutions for them and get it done and know that they're in the right because they have great context for what the organization needs to achieve, then you've got leadership everywhere.
And I was going to say exactly that. So that's a really good sign of strong leadership, the lasting impact and the continuous improvement to reach a goal and then go for the next level up, if you like, from there. I mean, in terms of a playbook, that seems like a pretty good model to start with, is to iteratively push yourself further and further in terms of what's possible capability wise. But I think also having those informal measures of success, like you had walking around and how often were you positively surprised? I think that's a great way to keep it sort of quite personal to the leader, because it can otherwise be quite lonely at the top if you don't have those kinds of fun sparks of satisfaction, I guess.
Yeah. I am quite drawn to quantitative measures, but I know that about myself. And so I was always looking for qualitative measures, you know. So what was there, things I could collaborate with the design team, you know, did we have enough, you know, input on to understanding not just what we needed to do, but why we needed to do it and things like that. And so.
Right. So that was on top of that core quantitative measurement, saying, are we improving, you know, are we going up and to the right effectively?
That's right. And when we, in terms of the quantitative, it wasn't just about dollars and revenue and profit. It was like, are we having the positive effect for the actual users that we're focused on? So, you know, are candidates able to apply for more relevant jobs? Are we increasing their chance to be noticed? You know, so getting right to the crux of what their jobs to be done were.
So crucial to keep both eyes on the users and the customer who's paying at the end of the day.
Yes. 100%.
Good. So if we could just round up then, I mean, if you were to, I mean, you clearly do this quite often, when you speak to, you know, CTOs who are either relatively new in position or coming into a new role, even if they're not CTO for the first time, when it comes to restructuring then, if you could sort of boil down your advice into sort of 3 points or so, what would be the top 3 pieces of advice you'd give to a new CTO?
So maybe the first one is, do you need to restructure? You know, pointing back to that reference to 6 simple rules. Like, is there another option? Number 2 would be, if we're going to restructure, have we a theory of how the new approach is going to work? So, like, basically, have we done the work? Have we done the thinking? Because we know this is going to have a big impact on people. And so, yeah, that would be number 2. And then number 3 would be, do we have a good understanding of what good progress looks like? So what does the success look like? What would be the leading indicators of success? What would be examples of going in the wrong direction? You know, what would be an example of risks being realized? Those sorts of things. So, yeah, those would be the three key steps for, you know, first checking yourself and then getting yourself ready and then finally going and getting started on the journey.
And I think that's one of the key things you put as an assumption underlying there is that it's getting started. It's not just doing it. It's turning it into an evolution from a, what did you call it? Done and done, finished kind of approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One and done was your expression, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, an organization that can keep evolving may do away with the need for some of the very large restructures because it is adjusting as things out in the marketplace or things internally change. And in the model that many companies take where there's a more rigid approach to change, it becomes very big and then it's left for a bunch of years until, you know, the change must be done because, you know, things are breaking too much. And then it's another seismic change. And so I think there's something. Now, look, I'm sure our listeners will be able to come back with examples where, you know, there was change that needed to happen and it wasn't that circumstance. But I believe that would cover a lot of cases.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. Absence of major external triggers. If you can make the change evolutionary and continuous, you're probably in for a smoother ride and a better experience individually from each person in the organization. Then, seismic is a really good way of expressing the changes that we often see in organizations when a new CTO joins.
That can be the experience. And having been on both sides of it and, you know, unfortunately, in some instances, having caused that for people, yeah, I definitely empathize with the experience.
On that note, Daniel, thank you very much. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you. How can listeners get hold of you or find you online?
So I have a blog, which is called Great CTOs Focus on Outcomes. So having listened to this episode, you might get a feel for why I have that title. So I write there weekly. So there's a lot of content. I've been writing there for 4 years. So there's over 150 posts that CTOs and other technology leaders would find valuable and informative. So, yeah, if you like what you heard today, then subscribe to my blog. It's at, do we have the URL? I'm assuming we can.
Yep, let's go for it.
So it's wiota.substack.com. So, yeah, it'll be in the show notes, I'm assuming.
We'll put the link in the show notes for sure. Yes, absolutely. So, well, what is the story behind that link, Wiota? Because you use that as your online handle in a number of places, don't you?
Yeah, you can find me on just about any service on the planet with that name. It's never taken. And when I was about 6 years old, I typed that into, I was trying to type my name quickly, and that's what came out into the high score table. So it stuck with me ever since.
What a great story. Cool. Daniel, thank you very much. And now the listeners know how to get hold of you. LinkedIn is another place where you're quite active as well, I've seen recently.
Yes.
And yeah, so thank you very much for sharing your insights and experiences with us today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Until next time, listeners, stay innovative and keep leading with impact. Thanks very much. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.